is on the black here as it goes around. Okay, now we'll continue. This is, you know, extremely helpful, kind of a diplomatic history too. And so now we were just talking about the night of August 2nd.
Well, the famous night, you see.
Yeah.
Well, then within a few moments then of my conversation with Tom, the Secretary General was told about it. The President of the Security Council was about it. I spoke with my colleague who was Under Secretary General for Security Council Affairs. I said, look, you better also start putting your socks on again and getting back to work, you see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we were back in the council chamber, at the end of the night, before we were back there. We were there before midnight, by the end of the night.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that started off, of course, this chain of resolutions on Chapter 7, unparalleled in UN history.
Mm-hmm, true.
And set this organization institutionally on a course that it had never followed before, which was to discipline a member state which had transgressed egregiously.
Right, yeah.
And it had never happened before, and God willing, it never will be so required again.
Yes.
But it was interesting to watch it as an insider. I felt a sense of exaltation that the council had come to life, but I had a sense of foreboding that we were having to discipline a member state in this manner.
Right. Yeah.
Because there was something about it. Which you know, it was, what shall I say, it left you pained, even as you were making the point that the Charter will triumph.
Right. Well, was there hope at any time, that the Secretary General, or did you and the rest of the staff have hope at any time that a negotiated settlement could be accomplished?
Well, we very much hoped that. I mean, I wouldn't say, I use the word hope in the sense of we hoped against hope that reason would prevail, but we had no illusions about the nature of Iraqi position. You see, the Iraqis were somehow convinced that A, they were not entirely in the wrong. Again, their own reading of the history of Arabia, you see. I mean, they were in a sense true to their reading of their own history.
Yeah.
You see,
yeah.
It's another matter that others didn't share that reading of history, and it's another matter, of course, that their reading of history collided 100% with the Charter of the UN.
Mm-hmm.
You see,
yeah.
But we can't say they didn't have their own sense of history. You see.
Yeah.
So in other words, we were up against a kind of impossible situation. And this is quite apart from the character of Saddam Hussein and so on, which that's another story altogether. Right? You know,
so from your description, it seems as though the intransigence was primarily fell on the Iraqi side. Did you feel that there was any intransigence on the side of the five or of the security?
You see, here we have a very serious question. I happen to belong to Asia. I believe very strongly on the one hand, the need to protect the sovereignty of Asian states. After all, we were subjugated for an awfully long time.
Yes, right.
But no less strongly, I believe in the need to live by agreed rules, you see.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I have devoted my life to serving the Charter of this organization.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that faced with the question of Iraqi claims and the defense of the principles of the Charter, for someone like me, and for most people at that time, there was no choice.
Right, okay.
The principle of the Charter had to be upheld.
Right.
The pity of it all was that the charter had to be upheld with such ferocity against a person who seemed to understand no other language. Mm-hmm. That was the pity of the situation, you see.
Right.
And in fact, you see, I mean, till this day it fills me with pain.
Right.
So the lesson had to be taught so severely.
Mm-hmm.
This was the pity of it. And at such cost,
Right, yeah.
Terrible cost.
Right.
But that was the nature of the lesson that had to be taught.
Right.
Now, it's another matter, and I'm not here going into the manner in which the war was conducted. I'm not going into what happened to Security Council in terms of adoption of Resolution 678.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not here going into the question of whether or not the Council lost control of the conduct of the war.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not here going into the question of whether or not the states and the Council were given an opportunity to express their views. Those are all separate subjects.
Right, yeah.
But I'm simply going into the question of whether or not Saddam Hussein, they could have been dealt with another way. And there, sadly,
mm-hmm.
it came to the fact, it came to the point, it all came to the melancholy conclusion
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that he didn't listen to people who went to him as friends,
mm-hmm.
as advisors. He wouldn't listen to threats, he wouldn't listen to blandishments, he wouldn't listen to friends, he wouldn't listen to anybody.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Was the Secretary General extremely frustrated during this period about...
Well, you see, Persequer never liked to admit to either discouragement or frustration.
I see.
In fact, one of the most moving things about Persequer was and he constantly said to me, you know, and we went through some very bad times. 1982 to 1986 were terrible years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The years of great adversity for this organization.
Right, yeah.
And Persequer exactly. stood, they were above all a test of character.
Mm-hmm.
And Persequer showed extraordinary character in those years.
Yes.
But I remember in those dismal years, he often would say to me, tired, worn out, fatigued by the end of the day, you know, assaulted by the problems he faced, the financial crisis, or this, or that.
Yeah.
He would say, of course, I do not have the right to be discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
I do not have the right to be discouraged. there he used the word right very interestingly. He didn't have the privilege of discouragement.
Right.
See, what you and I could claim.
Right.
As something which we could feel, we could shout and scream, tear out our hair.
Yeah.
Persequer did not have the right to be discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
You see. And I must say,
in the sense that he felt that there was so much responsibility.
Well, yes,
here.
Yes. He could not give way to discouragement.
It would.
He could not afford to be aggrieved.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You see.
Uh-huh.
He could not yield in his resolve.
Right, because the morale of the institution would depend on his morale.
Yes. And his perseverance was required despite of any apparent discouragement. He could not let others feel that he would be weakened by discouragement.
Yes.
You see. Now,
it's a very important quality.
It was a very important quality, you see.
Yeah.
And that's why I, for one, after 30 odd years in this organization, I'm convinced that the attribute of a section, above all that's important,
mm-hmm.
is the nature of the person. It's the character of the person.
Right.
Each Secretary General's tenure is nothing in the final analysis if not an essay on the character of the incumbent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You see?
Right.
The decisions a person makes,
mm-hmm.
They derive from the character of the person.
Sure. Yeah.
The choices a person makes derive from the character of the person.
Mm-hmm.
The way in which you read the charter and your own responsibilities under it come from your sense of who you are.
Right.
Persequer defined himself, you see, as he served in this job.
Yeah.
And with each year that he served in it, his definition of himself grew clearer and clearer. His sense of responsibility became more and more apparent to those who worked with him and those who viewed him.
Right.
And in some miraculous way, towards the end of his tenure, this test of character prevailed.
Right.
and he was able to reap certain fruit.
Right, yeah.
But the fact of the matter was, he worked as assiduously before the fruit ripened,
mm-hmm.
as he did at the time when everyone was praising him for the fruit he was harvesting.
Right, yes, yeah.
And there would have been no harvest but for the perseverance in bad seasons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, he seems to have an extraordinary concern for humanitarian issues.
Yes, but you see, again, you know, a person is a totality.
Right.
You see, mm-hmm. it's not that he had extraordinary compassion for humanitarian concerns.
Mm-hmm.
He was that type of person.
I see. Okay.
You see, in other words, he didn't suddenly bleed when he saw a child suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You see, but he had it in himself the capacity to bleed.
Yes. Okay.
You see.
Yeah.
In other words, it was intrinsic. Mm-hmm. He didn't need the stimulus of a starving child to worry about a child who was starving. You see.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In other words, his actions would be informed in such a way that he would have in mind the starving child, even if the issue was not about a starving child.
Right. Yeah.
The issue may be about aggression in Kuwait.
Right.
But in Pelagra's mind, it would be the aggression in Kuwait, but it would also be the fate of the civilian population.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah.
There would not be a dichotomy there.
Right.
You see?
Mm-hmm. The frustration seems to be, from what you're saying, though, that there was a kind of an inability to convey the reality of the situation to the Iraqi side.
Well, I would say yes, that was so. But I think what you had over here was you had an inability to convey to the Iraqi side, but you had a position of the Iraqis in which they were so entrenched, you see,
mm-hmm.
that no matter what you tried,
yeah.
It didn't seem to penetrate,
mm-hmm.
and someday I might just want to write of this myself, but I'm in no hurry.
Mm-hmm.
I have my own view about the nature of Saddam Hussein. I don't want to intrude in your reflections on this matter with my own views, but I shouldn't make you too subjective about these things. But I've got my own sense of that kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
What goes wrong, or what is right, what is grievously wrong. We make our own judgments about people and why they are as they are. But even after returning from Baghdad in order to catch the 15 January line, deadline,
mm-hmm.
even after returning here, when he reported to the council, and the council was in a state, you know, about
yeah.
how to proceed, the French were saying one thing, the Americans were saying something, the British were saying something else, and online they were going somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't quite know how to proceed. They tried to draft something, they failed to do so. The differences, even amongst friends, were too intense at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
They left it to Pérez-Aguirre to see what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then on that night, I think it was the 14th night, or the 15th, I forget now,
mm-hmm.
He made a very impassioned appeal
mm-hmm.
to Saddam Hussein.
Right.
Which I had a hand in writing.
Mm-hmm.
Saying to Saddam Hussein that if you fall in line even now, you know, mm-hmm. X, Y, and Z can follow.
Right.
And the worst can be avoided. And there might yet be a solution of some dignity for everybody.
Right.
But if you don't, then really God help us, because something awful can transpire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's exactly what happened.
Now, when you met in January in yeah. Baghdad with the Secretary General, mm. were you? In the meeting when he was speaking with Saddam Hussein?
Oh, yes, indeed, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what transpired in those conversations? They met for a couple of hours.
Yes, it was a long meeting. It was a long meeting. And there was a very full exposition of the situation by Saddam Hussein of the Iraqi position.
Uh-huh.
There was a very full exposition of the position of the United Nations by the Secretary General.
Mm-hmm.
There was an exchange of views. Saddam Hussein then suggested some ideas, but these still did not add up to compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it, you see. When the Secretary of State tried to probe him a little, he would sort of show a little and then cover, and, you know. In other words, the message he gave back to the Secretary General, for all his protestations to the contrary afterwards about the clarity of that message, was an ambiguous message. And it's now all part of the record.
Mm-hmm.
You would have seen his notes on the meeting. The Iraqis put out their version,
mm-hmm.
which was not wrong, except in certain instances it appeared that Persico had been kinder to Saddam Hussein than he had been in terms of the exposition of the UN's position.
Mm-hmm.
The Secretary General came back, we all traveled back like madmen from Iraq as far as Paris, and he came along on the Concorde while the rest of us came on a normal aircraft. We were held up for hours in Paris airport,
mm-hmm.
some flight delays and so on. Anyhow, we wrote the report out on the plane, and we came into New York, into UN headquarters later in the night, on the 14th I believe it was, had the thing typed out, cleared it with him. And he went down to the council that night and reported to them. And that report which he gave to the council in consultation was the whole truth, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, did Saddam seem to be nervous or tense, or was he...
No, he wasn't at all nervous.
No?
No, not really. He's a very composed person.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely composed. Composed, he was extremely well-mannered. He was solicitous,
mm-hmm.
in small things about the comfort of those there. He knew we'd been traveling a long time.
Yeah.
He was mindful of all of that. And he was extremely polite. And even to the point where he sensed that the room was getting too close and the air was getting too stifling, a window was open.
Mm-hmm.
That he felt there may be a draft, so the curtains were drawn, and all this kind of thing, and he was personally making sure all of this happened, you see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, he was, as far as the Secretary was concerned, as we were concerned in that meeting, his manners were exactly what they should have been, you see.
Right. Yeah.
It's another matter that earlier in the day we'd have to hang around for hours on end for this appointment with Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm. That it kept getting put off and put off.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the Secretary was particularly amused because he felt that Saddam Hussein, after all, should have received him first thing in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Secretary did understand that Saddam Hussein was having a meeting of his cabinet or his inner circle, Revolutionary Command Council, or whatever it's called,
mm-hmm,
in order to prepare for the discussions with
okay.
the Secretary. And that's all right.
Yeah, yeah.
Arafat was there running around, and Ortega was there running around,
mm-hmm.
all the rest of it.
Right.
So a certain the fact that the meeting wasn't held at 10 in the morning or even at 1 in the morning, in the afternoon, that didn't worry the Secretary at all.
Yeah.
I think he found it a little silly that Saddam was there and hadn't prepared sufficiently for his coming.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't offended in the way the newspaper suddenly wrote that he was offended because he wasn't received until the afternoon. No, the Secretary was, I think, annoyed that Saddam Hussein hadn't given enough prior thought to the discussions that were going to be held.
Yeah.
Again, you see, what it meant was that the man hadn't realized how close we were to midnight.
Right,
see.
Yeah,
so
that was the thing I was going to ask
you. I mean, the man...
Did all of this kind of his behavior point to the fact that he knew that, or that he really
well,
did not understand
you see,
that?
I've never quite been able to fathom that. Either he didn't realize that we were 1 minute to midnight,
mm-hmm.
or else he was resigned to midnight striking with all that it meant. Now, whether it was the latter or the former, I'm not too clear in my mind. I have a terrible feeling it might have been both. One part of his mind saying it's 1 minute to midnight. Mm-hmm. The other part of his mind saying, so what? Nothing is going to change anything. Mm-hmm. This thing is going to happen. Mm-hmm. You see. In other words, there was something about Baghdad. In the middle of January, there was something about Baghdad there which was just all wrong.
Mm.
You see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
So was it sort of strangely eerie? I mean, people had left the city.
Yes, people had left the city. It was strangely eerie. There was hardly a vehicle. Hardly, there was neither a dog nor a cat nor just one car away from the airport into town in the guest house where the section was staying. Hardly anybody on the road at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was strangely eerie. It was winter. There was a fog in the air. And it was it wasn't exactly a great bustling metropolis.
Right, right, yeah. So maybe there was a kind of a resignation to what was going to happen.
Yes, there was, you see. I think there was this curious mixture of nothing will happen and a resignation, but mm-hmm. it will happen, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people can be ambivalent.
Right. Do you think he misunderstood his own strength in terms of military strength?
I have another theory on that,
but
I'll keep that for myself.
Okay, that's fine.
I have a very peculiar and complicated idea of the nature of that conflict.
Uh-huh.
But my views are so subjective
right.
that I don't think it wouldn't really be germane to Don Javier's memoir.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I mean, they're so, my views on this are rather personal, and I'm probably quite wrong. But I have my own sense of peculiar schizophrenia in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And for that matter, about the nature of that war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's another matter altogether.
Now, there were, you know, unfortunately, or perhaps it was inevitable, but the Secretary General's initiative had to apparently wait until after Baker had spoken to Tariq
Aziz. Yes, I mean, I don't know what the section says about it himself, but I just felt awful that the section was in a sense boxed in
mm-hmm.
In his capacities what to say. And for that matter, even when to say it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it was quite clear to me, at any rate, that between the passage of 678, 29th November, if my memory holds.
Yes, 29th November, yeah.
Through to the 9th of January,
mm-hmm.
There was a kind of a hypnotic dance between the United States and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a mongoose and cobra act
mm-hmm.
in which they were fixated with each other.
Right.
And nobody else was allowed to come into the scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Neither by the one nor the other.
Right.
Iraq wanted to talk above all with the United States. They right. didn't want intermediaries and all the rest of it. I mean, they knew that the shots that they were to be called would be called in Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh.
And not by the European community or somebody else.
Okay, see? Yeah.
So
yeah.
there was this fixation in Baghdad to deal with Washington.
Okay, yeah.
And there was this kind of, I won't say this equal and opposite fixation in Washington to deal with Baghdad, but there certainly wasn't much encouragement to outsiders to come jumping in.
Right, yeah.
For fear that the messages might get mixed, the signals might get confused and so on and so forth.
Right, okay.
When from time to time the European community started making noises about how important they weren't exactly encouraged.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So until the Baker Tariq Aziz talks, which mm-hmm. ended we all know where,
right?
The field was as it were closed. See,
mm-hmm.
now, those talks finished on the 9th.
Right.
There wasn't a great deal of time left between then and the 15th.
Sure.
Was there?
Yeah. No. A few days.
There were 6 days left.
Yeah.
And in those 6 days, Fensquare went on the third day.
Right.
To Bahurel.
Sure. Yeah. Stopping, so the first opportunity he had.
Meeting President Bush before he went from here.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting the European foreign ministers in Geneva on his way to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And arriving in Baghdad from Amman.
Yeah, the purpose then of meeting with the European 12 was what?
Actually, it was to make sure we'd all be talking in some coherent manner.
Right.
You see, it is very.
And were you there at that?
Yes.
Meeting? Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. It is very important, you know, that the people involved in this whole thing should be in reasonably good shape in terms of each other.
Yes.
You know, the Secretary was very keen that the messages he conveyed to Saddam Hussein would be authentic.
Yes. Okay.
You see,
yes.
He didn't want there to be the slightest, what shall I say, confusion.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
About the nature of the messages.
Right.
You see, so he made a point of seeing George Bush.
Yeah.
And he had Bush's words down pat, so that if Saddam Hussein were interested in hearing and knowing where he stood vis-à-vis the United States, he wouldn't get one message from Baker in Geneva, one from Fensquare, heard from somebody else, and a fourth from somebody else, you see.
Yeah.
So Fensquare, who was extremely meticulous in this kind of thing, didn't want there to be any area of confusion.
Okay.
See.
Yeah.
The same with the Europeans.
Okay.
He wanted to make sure with them, A, what he wanted test out with them what he was going to say to Saddam. He wanted to make sure with them that he understood exactly where they stood. The European community, president, and the rest of it. So that again there would be no light, you see, between his interpretation of what they were was their position and what he would express it as being.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
And he wanted Saddam Hussein to know that he came not just, so to speak, solo.
Exactly, yeah.
But he came on behalf of the nations of the world, large and small, you know, great and little, the most powerful and the least powerful. He came on behalf of the nations of the world, you see.
Right.
So he was able to say to him, look, I've come here as a Secretary of the United Nations. I've come here as someone who's not an enemy of your country, but one who's wishes you well.
Yeah.
I come with the endorsement and the blessing of everybody. And what I'm going to tell you derives from my conversations with all of them. So will you please listen?
Right. Yeah. So it would be much more effective.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the point. And he made this explicit when he met Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
He told him whom all he has met.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Now, he met with Mitterrand shortly before he went to Geneva, the night before.
No, the morning, the same morning.
The morning,
God,
okay.
It was an awful, awful mess. I mean, we traveled from here overnight or something. It was a hideous affair.
Yeah, the night of the 10th, I think you left.
Yes, it was awful business. We got to Paris in the early hours.
Yeah, okay.
And from the airport, he went straight off to the Elysee Palace.
You know, incredible stamina that's required.
Yes, indeed.
Of this kind of work.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Unbelievable.
Indeed. You saw Mitterrand early in the morning in Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
He went straight to the Elysee Palace. And the rest of us, he went solo to meet Mitterrand.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of us went to Quai d'Orsay, waited for him there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went from there straight off to Geneva, a short hop. Thank God the French gave us a plane, or somebody gave us a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And then met with the 12. Barely had time to shower and shave, and off we went on the long road to Amman.
Now, as I understand that the French were more willing to give Perez de Cuellar a free hand in somewhat in negotiating with Saddam Hussein. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I forget now. You know, I'd have to really look back at notes of the time.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, the five appear to be monolithic, but no two countries have identical views.
Right, yeah.
There are always nuances that are different.
Mm-hmm.
But a free hand is not the right term to use.
Okay.
In relation to resolutions which are adopted under Chapter 7.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the French have always with this fair, they always, what shall I say? The French had a very special relationship with Fair Square.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, to me, he was kind of, I wouldn't say he was one of them, but they had a very special relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
They trusted his judgment immensely.
Yeah. Well, he speaks French fluently.
Of course,
he was ambassador
of course,
to France.
But of course, but you know, they just have this very particular kind of
okay.
feeling for
yeah.
For the Spezica. Now,